the Lagrangian that describes a spin half field and a spin zero field. And we saw interesting things about it last week, and we looked at it in detail, and I think we understand it a little better now. And within factors of two, I think I have things correctly. There are kinetic terms, there are mass terms, and then there are interaction terms, and then there is one thing that we found out that we haven't written at first, but gets generated whether we like it or not, something that looks like m phi squared phi. And again, there's some probably factors of half or whatever in front of the terms, but you can work it out for yourself. Then we used that Lagrangian to motivate supersymmetry. We saw how quadratic divergences cancel, and we discussed the star model. We saw that the star model has a scalar, namely the Higgs, and we wanted the same sort of mechanism, the supersymmetric mechanism, to protect those quadratic divergences, to protect the Higgs from those quadratic divergences. And so we started entertaining the idea that maybe the star model is supersymmetric, right? But now, I could have told you, I could have continued on and tell you all sorts of miracles and stories about supersymmetry, but we're doing physics, not other fields of humanity studies. So I won't tell you stories. Instead, we'll actually try to understand things a little bit in detail. So what is one thing, one big thing that is missing from this description of reality? Like, suppose I wanted to use this to describe reality. What kind of ingredients you can come up with that are really missing from this picture? I'm not looking for a yes wrong answer, but yeah, just something.
Dark matter?
Definitely, although we don't know about it yet because we're children. So what other things? For sure, dark matter is missing and it's still missing, unfortunately. But what other things that we do know about for sure? What kind of things are missing from the description? Some things that we see every day.
Bosons?
Well, there is a boson here.
Well, I mean, gauge bosons.
Gauge bosons. Why do we need gauge bosons? Well, let there be light, right? One thing we are very familiar with is light. You stir at it every day. And indeed, generally forces, this Lagrangian doesn't really have the kind of forces that we are used to in nature, those forces that are described as spin one particles, right? Or vector bosons or gauge bosons. So let's try to charge this Lagrangian. Let's try to give it some coupling to a vector boson, okay? And see what kind of structure emerges, all right? Yeah.
So you've said all the m's equal to zero? Is that conscious or?
I said all the m's equal to zero?
Not zero, so equal to each other.
Right. So as you saw maybe you didn't say in the tutorials, but I thought you saw in the tutorials that for to get supersymmetric relations, those masses have to be the same, those couplings have to be related to each other, right? I'll mention more of it as we go on, but. So in supersymmetry, the different parts of the supersymmetric representation have the same mass. In this case, it's the spin zero and spin half. But we'll see more of it today. So now, if we want to charge this Lagrangian, what kind of charge do we usually do? Let's start with the simplest charge, abelian charge. That means that we want to have some phase symmetry, right? So normally, if something carries a charge, it has this sort of symmetry. So this is a global charge, right? When you have a phase rotation. And if we wanted to do a gauge rotation, of course, then you all know that you make this phase into a space-time dependent phase, and you make the Lagrangian invariant under it, right? And we'll do that in a moment. But even already at the global phase, if we think about the global phase, this Lagrangian manifestly violates this transformation, right? Because this term is not invariant under this transformation. So let's get rid of it. Okay. Now, what other terms are not invariant on this transformation? Well, this term as well is violating this charge, right? This term is not invariant under clearly phi just transforms to itself. So let's get rid of it. What other term is violating that? Well, given that I want the charge of phi and the charge of psi to be the same, right? You don't have to, but that's what we'll want. We want the charge to be the same. Clearly, this coupling also violates this global rotation, right? So I want to get rid of this coupling as well. But, so that's easy to do. But if I do that, then what other charge, what other term that is actually invariant, I need to get rid of? Well, this term, the quartic term, is in fact invariant under this transformation. But because of supersymmetry, we saw that this coupling is related to the couplings that I just erased, and so I should also get rid of this one. Even though it is invariant under under the charge conjugation, under charge rotation, and similarly for this term, for the mass term, for the scalar, it is also invariant. But since I don't have a charge, so since I don't have a mass for the fermion, I also should not have a charge, a mass for the scalar. And this is a really boring theory. I'm just left with the kinetic term. Okay, that's true, but I'm not done yet, right? With the whole point of erasing all those terms is because I want to charge this theory. And we all know how we charge things. If I want to make this phase dependent on space-time, then I need to introduce some gauge field, which will denote as a mu. Now, have you seen gauge fields before? Do you know the whole how you promote derivatives to covariant derivatives, all that? Okay, so we'll just do that. And so instead of di mu, we have d mu, right? And instead of d mu here, we have d mu. And by d mu, we mean it's the derivative plus I g a mu. Okay, where g is now my coupling constant. So already the theory is a lot more interesting, right? Because now, if I think about it in terms of Feynman rules, I have in this term, secretly there is hiding a three-point function that connects the scalar to the gauge boson, and there is a four-point function, right? And then here there is, again, a three-point function. All those interactions make life interesting, right? They describe scattering, they describe long-range forces, they describe structure. Okay, but we're not quite done yet, because if we want to keep this theory supersymmetric, we will find out if we did things in glorious details and do all the formalism supersymmetry, that just like there was a boson phi for the fermion psi and vice versa, there has to be some other spin half for the gauge field we just introduced. So we introduce this gauge field. We'll need to introduce some other fermion that comes with it to make the theory supersymmetric. And we'll denote this fermion by lambda. Okay? And it has an index alpha that reminds you that this is a vile spinor, right? It's a 2 by 1 spinor. So in some sense, this spinor is the same as this psi, right? It has the same space-time kind of structure, but it belongs with A, whereas phi belongs with psi. Okay? So let's write a kinetic term for it. So first let me write the kinetic term for A. So you all know that it looks something like F mu nu, right? Where F is di mu A nu minus di nu A mu, right? You're all familiar with the structure, the field strength. But I similarly have to write some sort of kinetic term for lambda, and that is just given by the same sort of structure as for the other fermion, right? Now, notice that I did not write a covariant derivative. I've written a regular derivative. And the reason is because just like the photon, right, doesn't talk to itself, if you look at the derivatives that we've written for the photon itself, there is no self-coupling. There is no photon-photon-photon vertex. Similarly, because this is the supersymmetric partner of it, this particle, what we'll call the photino, does not feel the photon itself. We'll see a more general structure in a bit, but to start things easy, for abelian theories, there is no coupling between the fermion and the vector boson. Okay, so this really is the full kinetic term. And so now we started for a little bit, and what is another term that we could write down? It turns out that there is one last term that we could write down, and that's actually an interaction term. And it looks something like this. The square root 2 is just for convenience. There is a coupling between psi, lambda, remember the alpha sit like that, and phi. Okay? And what kind of interaction is it? If you think about the Feynman diagram, it's a fermion. There is another fermion, which is the lambda. So this is psi, this is lambda, and then there is phi. Okay, phi star. It's a three-point vertex. And it describe a new kind of interaction that we have not seen before. Well, secretly we have seen it. It's just a Yokawa interaction, but it involves different fields. All right? And you see that it conserves charge, right? When psi rotates by a phase, phi rotates by an opposite phase, and lambda doesn't rotate. So it's charge invariant, and it turns out that it's also supersymmetric. Okay. So one way to understand where this is coming from is to think about this term, right? The interaction, the kinetic term for the fermion contains something that looks like this vertex. It contains psi bar sigma bar dot A psi, right? The kinetic term for the fermion contains this interaction term. Now, if we do a supersymmetric transformation, A goes to lambda, psi goes to phi. And you get something that looks like psi lambda phi. Okay? This is roughly where this term is coming from. And this is why it carries a G, because it's the same G that stands in front of this term. All right, so that's the intuitive reason why you have such a term. But that intuitive reason is telling us that maybe there is actually another term, because there is also something coming from this sort of structure. And indeed, there is a term that looks like g squared over 2 phi star phi squared. Remember, we erased this term before. We had a term like that in the original Lagrangian. We erased it because we said that the Yokawa is 0, so that should also be 0. But now we are reintroducing it because it is actually not related to the original Yokawa we had. It's related to the other structure we have here. Okay. And again, it is charge invariant. So in that respect, it's okay. All right, and this term describes a four-point interaction of four scalars. All right, and that's it. This theory, despite the fact that it's extremely simple, right, with only a handful of terms, describes a very interesting dynamics. It describes the interaction of two spin half particles, a spin 0 and a spin 1. Right, so we have in this theory spin 1, spin 1/2, spin 0, and spin 1/2 again, and they all interact with each other. And we could write the Feynman rules, and we'll do it in a short while, not the entire thing, and we can try to understand what kind of things emerge from it, but let's try to stir it for a little while, and then we'll generalize it to make it even more complex, even though it will still remain fairly simple. All right? But again, if you think about it for some time, you'll see that really there is some intuitive reason why this all makes sense. Right? The terms that we've written are charge invariant. They sort of smack of supersymmetry. And I'll show you in a moment a way of writing it in a manifestly supersymmetric way. This is not manifestly supersymmetric. You'll actually have to work a little hard to actually show that it's supersymmetric. But I'll show you in a moment how to make this whole thing a little more transparent. Okay? All right. So this theory does describe something that looks a little bit more like reality because it has light, right? This vector boson, or this gauge boson A, describes a massless spin 1 particle, which is what we call the photon. Now, is this sufficient? Are there other things in reality that this may not explain? Huh? Masses, that's right. But, you know, if we were just describing electrons and photons, maybe we are still okay. You know, those things are light. You're right. Ultimately, we will have to contend with the fact that things have mass. And we have already started seeing how we can do that, right? We can give things a mass. We just have to break the charge. Or if we have several fields and they transform under oppositely under charge, then we can actually make a real charge, a real mass term. But there are other things that we can more easily get before we do those complicated stuff. What other things in reality exist that this doesn't describe? This is an open question, so there's, of course, no right and wrong. But what other things that might just jump at you that if we already have all this structure, we can easily get that other stuff? So if you already worked very hard to get an abelian theory, you know, might as well add a few more indices and get another abelian theory, right? It's not that different. So what I want to show you now is how to actually get an non-abelian theory out of it. And the reason why we want it is because ultimately two out of the four forces in nature are non-abelian gauge theories, right? The strong force, or what we call QCD, and the electroweak. So let's just see how we can fairly easily generalize this structure to give us something which is non-abelian. All right? So how many of you, let's see, how do we do it? So, okay. So yeah.
So gravity is also non-abelian in some sense, right?
That's right. So if you like three out of the four forces, but I just meant in the gauge theory sense. So how many of you seen gauge theory, like non-abelian gauge theories before? You all seen it? Okay, so we'll go a little fast, but really we sort of already have all the ingredients to get what we need. So what changes? What changes mostly is the way things interact. And so for example, F mu nu becomes now become something which itself has an interaction, right? Something that looks like, let me start first. The gauge field itself now carries an extra index, not just a space-time index, but an index that tells you which generator it is. We have to choose some sort of some sort of group. So let's choose SUN. Really, it doesn't matter for anything that I'll do. But what matters really when you choose the group is that you need to choose the structure functions, right? And the structure functions are defined by the generators of the group. So the generators, I'll call them TA and TB, right? And they are based on commutation relations that looks like FABC, TC, right? TA, TB, TC are some matrices. They define the group. FABC are what's called the structure functions. Have you all seen this? Okay, so this is what defines the group for us. And really, it doesn't matter whether I do SUN, SO2, SO100. All I need for discussing this business is FABC, right? The structure functions. So this gets multiplied by the generator and becomes a matrix, right? So really, I should not talk about A by itself now. When I write A without an index, what I secretly mean is A TA, right? But I'll just often omit the T just for simplicity. And so here I can just add the commutator of A mu and A nu, right? And if you use these relations and you work out the commutation relation, you see that because this is secretly A mu TA, A nu B, TB, this is really A mu A nu B commutator of TA TB. And then we use this relation to write this as A mu A nu B FABC IUC. Right? So we can in fact write this whole thing explicitly in terms of the gauge fields themselves, but we don't really need it. As long as we remember that now this F is a matrix, it's not just a number, okay, a complex number. All right, so using this, we can write the field strength, and we have minus a quarter, and now I have to trace, because it's a matrix, right? So we have F mu nu, and the trace just takes those matrices and turns them into numbers, because ultimately your Lagrangian has to be a number. Right, so this is what happens to the gauge field. For the interactions, instead of those simple fields, we need to talk about things that transform non-trivially under the gauge symmetry or the general symmetry. So let's do this. So just like I had indices on my gauge fields, I need to introduce indices on my matter fields. So instead of psi and phi, I now have psi I and psi and phi I, right? And they transform into e to the I ta psi, and this t carries indices ij, j, e to the I, t a, I j, phi j. And the only things that you should keep in mind is that these t's are the generators, but they don't necessarily sit in the same representation as these t's. The representations that you use for the gauge fields has to be what's known as the adjoint representation, okay, or the defining representation. Those generators, they obey the same commutation relation, okay? They obey the same structure functions, but they can be in a different space. This could be a 3x3 space, this could be a 2x2 space, right? Normally, they are in the fundamental for matter fields in the Stahl model, they're all in the fundamental. Sometimes they're in higher representation when you do beyond the Stahl model. But the two most important representations are the fundamental and the adjoint. Okay, so this is how they transform, and theta is again some space-time phase. And in order to make sure that the Lagrangian is invariant, now the covariant derivative has to be something like di mu plus I g a mu. And you know what, let me just so that it's not confusing, let me write, instead of t, I will use tau, just to remind you that those are not the same as those matrices. And A multiplies tau. And if I now take, for example, my spinor, and I write, I'll keep the indices on it, I, and I have sigma d, sigma mu d mu, and now this guy carries two indices, I and j, that has to do with the indices of this matrix, tau, right? It's a 2x2 matrix. So sorry for notation, but it's good to do it once fully. And of course, in front of the derivative, there's just the identity matrix. Okay? And so this guy carries some indices, psi and j. And so this is how we write the kinetic term for the matter. All right? And similarly, we can write the kinetic term for the scalar, something that looks like d mu phi square, and you contract all the indices to make it work. All right? Now, so for the matter field, it's fairly easy, but the question is, what happens to that one remaining field, the spinor field, the Gugino, right? This lambda that we introduced. Remember that here, when we introduced it here, it did not have any interaction with the gauge field. But now we know that if we talk about non-abelian theories, because the gauge field itself interacts with itself, we can expect that if this respects some sort of supersymmetry, then if the gauge field interacts with itself, then it should also interact with its partner, the Gugino, right? Because under supersymmetry, you will exchange the two. And so if one interacts with itself, it should also interact with its partner. And so we should expect some sort of modification to this kinetic term. And indeed, this is exactly what happens. Now this lambda is in the adjoint representation. It obeys, it has the same sort of matrices as these ones. And so we write lambda bar sigma bar mu d mu lambda, where d mu now is equal to di mu plus lambda will carry the same sort of index as A does. So we'll write A and B, and this D now is a matrix A and B. So I'm using A, B, and C to denote adjoints, and I use I, J, and K to denote fundamental representations. Okay? And so this matrix looks something like this: G, F, A, B, C, TC, A, sorry, I screwed up. There is no what? Sorry, thank you. Ah, good, thank you. Exactly. F, A, C, mu. Okay? So, this now charges the Gugino under the gauge field, and I have a new Feynman vertex. I have a Feynman vertex where I have Gugino, gauge field, which describes the interaction of the Gugino with the gauge field itself. All right? And if you want to be careful about the indices, there is an index here, there is an index here, and there is an index here, and this is proportional to FABC. Times G. All right? Now, let's just stop for a moment and stare at it and understand where we stand, because Now we will take this and see how we can apply all of it to the STAM model and get the entire minimal supersymmetric standard model. Right. So just to recap, we started with a fairly simple theory that we just said, okay, we wanted to couple it to some gauge field, we wanted to have charge, so we introduce a vector field, supersymmetry forces us also introduce a partner, the gaugino, right, the partner of the gauge field, lambda. In this abelian case, it had no coupling to itself. Things were simple. I didn't need to have too many indices in life. But it also wasn't realistic enough because we want to describe QCD. We want to describe electroweak. And so we said, okay, it's worth the effort of putting a few more indices. And we did that. And most of it is fairly straightforward and trivial. You just add indices, right? There was no real change here. I just added indices, but the interactions remain the same. The kind of vertices you had in this theory were pretty much the same, right? There is the fermion-fermion gauge field. There is the scalar-scalar gauge field. All of those things remain the same. The most interesting parts came in the gauge sector itself, where suddenly the gauge field itself was charged, right? It has its interaction with itself. And the gaugino was now charged. And you got a new vertex. So that's where the real meat of this extension lies. It's not in all the silly indices. Yeah.
Are
you need to write it with indices, and you basically have fundamental adjoint fundamental, which is invariant. Because the adjoint is, it's like n and bar.
Oh.
So you just need to add indices on it and it will be invariant. That's a good question. Yeah.
So we rewrite the adjoint as two fundamental and
that's right.
Fundamental indices.
Right. Okay, so are there any questions on the indices, the structure, any things that I've done too casually that you don't like, yeah.
So could can we show that lambda has to interact with A, or is it something we put in by hand to get, what is the status of the?
Right, so I have not proved to you that this is supersymmetric or that even supersymmetry requires this. I just gave you a heuristic argument that said that, you know, if we want lambda to be some sort of supersymmetric partner, then you sort of expect, just what we mean by supersymmetry, is that I exchange spin half for spin zero, or spin half for spin one. And so if I have some sort of interaction like this, where I have a gauge boson interacting with itself, if I change one of them to the partner, I expect to start seeing interaction between the gauge field and the gaugino. So that's the heuristic argument for why you expect to suddenly see these sort of terms.
Okay,
yeah.
And the second question was, does lambda interact with itself also then?
No, there is no term like lambda, 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 right? So there could be a term lambda, lambda. That'll be a mass term, and that, in fact, breaks the gauge symmetry. So we don't want that for now. You might want to have a lambda, 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 or something a little more complicated than that, but that's higher dimensional because lambda is a fermion, so it carries mass dimensions. So this really is the entire description of the theory, which is fairly remarkable that, you know, a fairly straightforward manipulation of ideas, right? Starting with saying I want force, so I add massless gauge field. I want it to be supersymmetric, so I add a gaugino. I want it to be non-abelian, so I add some indices. And it's sort of remarkable that out of those simple considerations, we got a fairly complicated theory. Complicated not in the sense of it or it's ugly, but complicated in the sense that it has very rich dynamics. Right? Many things interact between themselves. And in fact, those theories manifest some of the most beautiful phases that we have found of fundamental matter in the last 40 or so years. Okay, and there are extensions of these theories into larger supersymmetries. But very generally, those non-abelian supersymmetric theories are extremely, extremely beautiful. Okay, we're not going to say anything about them in this course, And it's not entirely clear yet whether they have anything to do with nature, but well, at least in the sense of fundamental particles. But nevertheless, they're beautiful and worthy of studying. If nothing else, because they may give us some sort of tools to understand things in analytic ways. Okay. Alrighty. So any other questions on this? Yeah. Go for it. There will be time for all of you. So go for it.
Okay. So it seems like the covariant derivative. The original gauge field is special. In the sense, it's more special than its supersymmetric partner in the sense that it appears in the covariant derivative, whereas
right.
The supersymmetric partner never appears in the covariant derivative. So, is there a reason for this? Like, I would expect it totally, I expect both to be present.
You can think of this term as the supersymmetric partner of the covariant derivative, because this is roughly where it's coming from. So, if you think about the gauge field, where does it appear? So let's forget about the fact that we call it covariant derivative, because that's just a convenient packaging to make things manifest. But ultimately, what does it do? It creates these sort of couplings, right? Gauge field, fermion, fermion. This is precisely what this term is. It's just a supersymmetric version of it. It's fermion, fermion, scalar. So in some sense, it's not more special. The fermion does just the same things. It's just packaged a little differently. The reason why you don't see the three fermion fields is just because those terms are irrelevant.
For example, does it not appear in the covariant derivative? The kinetic term for scalar field?
Say that again?
Will it appear in the, or is that a higher?
That would be a higher dimensional theory. Oh, so the only thing that you can write down, which is the right dimensions, is this operator.
Okay.
And this operator is indeed mimicking the term fermion-fermion gauge field or scalar-scalar gauge field. It's a supersymmetric version of it.
Okay.
So in that sense, there is nothing special about the spin one field.
In some sense, it's not. It's a little asymmetric in this way because of the dimensions.
Right.
So we have interacting term between the three gauge bosons. So why do we have the interaction between the three lambda fields?
Yeah, right. So that's what I mentioned here is that you might suspect that something might occur, but that's a higher dimensional operator, so it's irrelevant. In fact, it's more than that. You have to find a way to contract the Lorentz indices a little better. So. That really doesn't appear also because of Lorentz invariance.
But we also have the third term. It's also the non-cage.
This one?
I mean, the third term in the first line.
5-5 star. Right, where does that come from? That's your question? So let's now show things in slightly more supersymmetrically manifest ways, and we'll see where those things come from. Okay. Any other questions? But what I want to, I'm going to do some more formal stuff now.
Do we have time for that?
Yeah. So let's leave the mathematics for next time. But because I do want to show you how some of it comes out very beautifully with a different formalism. But before we delve into the formalism, are there any more questions about the intuitive picture of why you get what you get? Because that's ultimately what some of the important part for understanding how to see and produce those particles and all that is to understand what kind of interactions you get in these theories. So we all good on that?
Yeah, can I just clarify? So lambda has a Lorentz index as well. But
It's a spinor. I think I've written it, right?
Okay.
This is the index I'm talking about. This is the spinor index.
So it does not carry the spatial index, like A.
So if it's an abelian case, it doesn't carry any more indices. It's really a neutral particle. But in the non-abelian case, I've written it here, And because of so many indices, I suppress some of the indices. But if I introduce it, I will write a beta dot alpha, alpha. And now you see that lambda carries two indices. It carries the symmetry, the gauge symmetry index, and it carries a space-time index. Okay, so lambda is a spinor. It carries this index, but it also carries a. All right.
So under supersymmetry, are phi fields sort of pairs with the psi field?
Right.
And so in that case, the lepton is 1/2 higher spin. But with the A and the lambda, we have a spin 1 pairing with spin 1/2. It seems to me sort of intuitively that the spin 1 should pair with the spin 3/2.
There is also that representation. So that's a good, great question. So it leads to the next issue that when we talk about the kind of symmetries that you're used to, right, Lie algebras, SUN, SON, one thing you have learned is that each one of those symmetries, there is some defining algebra to it. Here we have written here the defining algebra. But what's relevant for physics is the actual representations of those symmetries, right? SUN has the fundamental representation. So let's talk about SO3, right? That's a symmetry we all know and love because it describes our real world, right? Rotations. And so there is this representation where I make something into a 3 vector and it transforms in a certain way under this symmetry. But there are also things like tensors, right? Pij, for example, and it transforms in a different way under this symmetry. Each one of those examples, and there are higher representations and there are many more representations, but each one of them is furnishes a representation of this symmetry. Okay. Similarly, supersymmetry is what's known as a graded Lie algebra. It's not defined by a commutation relation, it's defined by an anti-commutation relation. But other than that, it's very similar to this sort of idea that aside from the algebra, there is also representations of it. And this simple two fields, phi and psi, furnish one of the simplest representations that we know of supersymmetry, and that's called the chiral superfield. Okay? So, phi and psi furnish what's known as the chiral superfield. Chiral just refers to the fact that this fermion is chiral. Right, it's left-handed, or rather it doesn't carry a mass, it's a massless vial spinor. Superfield just refers to the general formalism that we will not do in this course, but it's a nice formalism that allows you to package things together in a way that makes supersymmetry completely manifest. Okay, and we'll touch on it a little bit, but we won't quite do it. But one thing that comes out of the superfield formalism is that actually this multiplet is insufficient. It's sufficient if you only talk about on-shell relations, about things that obey the equations of motion. But to make things absolutely manifest in the quantum Lagrangian, it turns out that you need to introduce one more field, which is known as the auxiliary field, and is usually denoted by F. Okay, and we'll see in a moment. It's not a propagating degree of freedom. It doesn't affect any of the dynamics or the phenomenology of this theory. And that's why I haven't written it, because it doesn't actually carry any physical significance in that sense. But it is very useful to introduce it to see supersymmetry manifest. Okay? So those three together form what's called the chiral superfield. On the other hand, the gauge field A, and actually, let me write it this way. Lambda A, they furnish what's called the vector superfield representation. For obvious reasons, this is a vector field. And Very similarly to the case of the chiral superfield, there is, in fact, another ingredient that I haven't mentioned, and that's known as D. And again, it is not a propagating degree of freedom. It doesn't affect any of the phenomenology or any of the dynamics. But it is very useful to introduce it in order to make supersymmetry manifest, as we'll do in a moment. Okay? In terms of indices, they all carry the symmetry index A. And you really remember that it should be multiplying by TA. So every one of them is really a matrix, the adjoint representation of SUN or whatever other. So TA is the adjoint representation of your gauge group. But their space-time indices are different. This guy carries an alpha, this guy carries a mu, and this guy doesn't carry any space-time index. Okay, it's in fact a scalar. Very similarly, if we want to make our matter fields charge, then we just have to introduce an index I here, and psi is the only one that carries a space-time index. Okay? And the I is just in whatever representation of the gauge group you have, which here. So for example, tau can be in the fundamental. Right. So let's briefly, in the last 10 minutes of the lecture, introduce this formalism of making it. Yeah.
These F and these D fields, do they also belong to the class of fermions or bosons?
Does it also what?
Belong to the class of fermions or bosons?
In a sense, yeah. Those are bosons in the sense that they don't, you know, it's a scalar and it's a normal number. Unlike lambda and psi, which are Grassmannians, that's something that I have sort of not mentioned at all because by now you're familiar with it. Fermions are Grassmann variables, right? So psi and lambda, in fact, anti-commute. If you move them through each other, you get a minus sign. All the other fields we introduced are normal numbers.
So the gauge, you know, I'm having a little bit of problem just seeing its gauge invariance. Would there be a trace? I mean, we can write the F mu nu squared term as a trace. Is that?
Yeah, you can probably do that here if you kept things in terms of matrices rather than actual indices. So I think it would work. But basically, those are just three adjoints, and you can contract them together to get an invariant. Maybe introducing a trace is the easiest way of doing that. Right, so let's very briefly see how we can write something that is manifestly invariant. So, here we go. What was the easiest way of doing it? So the free Lagrangian. So let's do the matter fields first, and then we'll do the gauge fields. The free Lagrangian is again the usual interactions: di mu phi plus I psi bar sigma dot d psi. And now I will also write this f term, f star f. And if we wanted to introduce the gauge field, we just have to add indices everywhere, but we'll do that a little later. And notice, most importantly, is that F does not have a derivative acting on it, right? It is just what you're familiar with as an auxiliary field. It's just a Lagrange multiplier or whatever else you want to call it. It doesn't have any dynamics of its own. And we can just integrate it out if you wanted to. And then there is an interaction term that looks like for our purposes, it really only looks like let's write like this: wi fi. So the I is just in terms, if we have more than one field, we have that, and that's pretty much it. Right. We could add one more term that looks like psi wij psi I psi j minus a half. If we had more than one fermion, which is indeed what happens in the star model, you have more than one fermion, and that's it. And these W's are something that we won't discuss much of, but for our purposes, those are just polynomials of the scalar fields. So there are some scalar field or scalar field square, but they all come, in fact, from one entity called the superpotential W. And derivatives of the superpotential with respect to the scalar field gives you wi and wij. Okay. So one example of the superpotential that is good for our purposes is something that looks like a half mij. And now again, I'm assuming that I have several fields in my theory. 6 y I j k phi I phi j phi k. And so, for example, w I is just a derivative with respect to the scalar phi I, and w I j is the second derivative with respect to phi I and phi j. Okay? So if you take this W and you differentiate it, as I said, you will get mass terms and you will get interaction terms. Those are things that we haven't included in our Lagrangian because we wanted charge invariance, but they were there in the very first Lagrangian we talked about, where we had mass terms and Yukawa terms and all those things. Okay? If you have multiple fields, you can even do that when you have a conserved charge. You just have to charge fields appropriately. Okay, so that's something you can play with on your own. It's fairly straightforward once you understand the principle. That's it. To show that this is gauge invariant, I'm afraid we'll have to do next time. So let's stop here, and we'll pick up some of it next time.